Welcome to the Humanergy Leadership Podcast. I'm David Wheatley, and we're here to talk all things leadership. My guest this week is Keith Hollis, and I got Keith on today to talk about what it takes to lead a ragtag bunch of dropouts across the Atlantic Ocean in a 39-foot boat. Keith, good to see you.
I think you're talking about yourself as a ragtag bunch of dropouts, but yeah, good to see you too.
Well, I call all of us that, but for some people that listen to this, they may know, but others won't, that 2015, you and I shared an adventure with a couple of others to sail the Atlantic. But if we go a step back from that, I want to share your bio in about 30 seconds shortly, but all the way up to 2014, when you retired and bought a boat. So what got you to that point? What have you been doing prior to that?
Okay, well, sailing was from very early on. I started sailing with school when I was 12. As I got older and bigger, I could afford bigger boats. I worked at Camp Windermere, as you know, as a sailing instructor, basically. And I had the pleasure of teaching you as a teenager, and a guy called Tony Hill, who also thought he was a teenager, but was probably 30 years old at the time, how to sail. And from then on, I spent 30 years at the Metropolitan Police, ended up working at Scotland Yard for my last 7 years, and retired in 2014.
So you retired in 2014 and then took your vast savings and dumped it into a boat that you'd never seen in real life.
Correct.
And that boat was in Antigua? No, BVI, wasn't it?
It was British Virgin Islands. Yeah. For many years, I really don't know when the plan was formulated. As far back as I can remember, I had this plan to retire, having bought a boat and sail around the Caribbean for a winter. And that is exactly what happened.
So you bought a boat, 39-foot boat that was based in BVI. You spent the winter on it solo, pretty much, or some occasional guests. But that fall of 2014, you announced that you planned to sail it back to England in the spring and were looking for crew.
I didn't actually say I was looking for crew. I announced that I was going to have this boat in the Caribbean and at some point would be sailing back, at which point I had two separate "I'm very interested" type messages from an aforementioned Tony Hill, who I'd not seen in 25 years. And strange enough, some guy in the States and his wife, who I had met 25 years before, saying, "Yep, we'll do it."
Well, that was even funny because I came home and said, Keith's bought a boat and he's going to sail it back from the Caribbean to England in the spring. And I've said I'll go with him. And I was told, "Not without me, you're not."
And so I believe you told me that conversation. And having since met Launda, I can understand why she was going to come also.
So it's the spring of 2015, and you're in the Caribbean, and your crew, the volunteered crew to help you sail it back across the Atlantic, shows up in the Caribbean, and it's made up of Tony Hill, who you've talked about, who's mountaineer, former paratroop, all a whole host of stories that he tells, some of which may be true. And he volunteered, and then me and Launda, who, even though, you know, I've had some background in outdoor ed and sailed and kayaked in my formative years, I'd not sailed for a while. And I believe it was the first time Launda stepped on a sailing boat was when she stepped onto the Ruby May in the spring of 2015. So you were the skipper, owner of the boat, you're taking this motley crew. What were some of the things you had to think about in order to work out who you were picking, what the crew was, and what you're going to do to make sure that this was a safe and reasonable adventure?
Well, I think firstly, the plan in my head, I'd been through this plan for years. So it wasn't something that I just decided to do. I'd been over and over it again. I knew exactly how it was going to work, but I just hadn't got the people to do it. Having yourself, Launda, and Tony along, when you volunteered, obviously I knew you and Tony, and I knew your backgrounds. I knew how much sailing Tony had done because I'd taught him for 2 days, 30 years before. So I was aware of Tony's ability. And I was reasonably aware of your ability being somewhat surpassing Tony's, but still a little bit ancient. But the qualities that I was getting with the crew made up far more than the sailing ability, because I knew I had dependable people with me, people who could make the right decision. And that was far more important than sailing. I taught you to sail in the 2 weeks before we left.
Right. So it was less about the technical ability and whether we knew it or whether we could do it on our own. It was more about, could you live with us for 7 weeks?
No, it wasn't, could I live with you for 7 weeks? It was 7.5 weeks and it felt longer.
Felt much longer.
the qualities that came with you and Tony were level-headed. You were rational, not irrational. And I knew that if something serious happened, you'd make the right decisions, whether that be sinking or fire, or anything ridiculous like that. I knew that when it comes to it, you'd be dependable. That was what I needed in a crew.
Well, we'll get back to what you just talked about there a bit later on. But so you're looking for dependable people. And you know, one of the pieces, I'd had the experience of actually renting the box room from you in your house for about a year in a previous life. So you knew you could live with me just about. As long as you didn't mind the biscuits and the chocolate getting stolen. And the other interesting thing is you picked four ex-cops somewhere along the line. Does that play into it, or was that just a coincidence?
I think it's just coincidence. The fact that I knew all of you outside of my police work and before my police work, it was coincidental.
Right.
The fact that you had those skills and abilities probably made you rounder people anyway, people that thought more along the same lines as I did. But we all knew each other before we joined the police service.
Right. Yeah. And so you wanted some people who weren't going to panic under pressure, mostly, and that could put up with each other for a while.
It was important having people that I could rely on, because I wanted to sleep. For 7.5 weeks, you cannot go without sleep. It's really important that you get that rest, both as a skipper on a boat or the crew, because you cannot function if you're tired. And for 7.5 weeks, it would have been very stressful. What I didn't know some of the other skills that came along with you that I was unaware of, and they proved to be so beneficial.
I won't go too much into some of those. I know one in particular you're going to point out with one particular person on the trip that became essential later, but we'll get to that. So 2 weeks in the Caribbean, just about, to train this crew to a place that you felt you were comfortable. And I guess at any point there was always the emergency bailout button that you could kick somebody off and they could fly back home if it wasn't going to work.
That was never going to be the case, though.
So then what was it that you had planned for? And I knew you enough to know that you'd meticulously planned and missed the safety about everything. So, but what was it you had planned for that 2 weeks? What did you set in place to make sure that you felt comfortable?
We did a lot of sailing. We did a lot of practice of the drills. So we practiced throwing things overboard, pretending they were one of us, and we picked them up. We went from place to place. We did everything in that 2 weeks. We sailed at night. We sailed for very long periods of time, 2.5 days, which is no different to sailing for 7.5 weeks, really. Once you get into that rhythm, you're in the rhythm. It was a case of, I wanted you to know the boat as well as I did, but far more important than knowing the boat, I wanted every one of you to be absolutely confident in the boat.
So then if we take the person who I think got them probably most out of the journey, Launda, my wife there in the world, had stepped onto the first sailing boat on the day she stepped onto Ruby May in Antigua. And, you know, constantly says she was frustrated with what she did, but also loved the teaching. So you're teaching two people that have sailed before and get some of the gist of some of it, and somebody who's a complete novice. How did you compensate that full range of education experience that had to go on in the first 2 weeks?
I think I didn't consciously compensate that at all. I took you all at a level that I thought was competent anyway, and then we just worked on those skills. So I didn't assume anyone was a beginner by all of us being involved right from the very start. So that's me, you, Launda, Tony. We were all doing everything. And because we were all doing everything, we all learned everything. Mm-hmm. We all learned something.
We all learned something. Well, and, you know, Launda characterizes it as she was on the boat with three men who were all very different. You know, that she characterizes me as the person who just wants to help her out and do things for her because that's what being part of our relationship. And Tony is that consummate English officer type that would tend to say he knew stuff, but then when Launda checked down below, she'd find out that some of it wasn't completely accurate. And and then you, who she says is still one of the best teachers she ever had, because as she was learning to drive the tender and would regularly drive it around in circles, you had the patience of Job to let her learn how to do that.
I was having a whale of time. Going around in circles was just fantastic. I loved it.
But you could see where, you know, that would be frustrating in some people. I mean, I guess that your planning and your thinking was it didn't matter whether we're going around in circles. You're building confidence, you're building experience, and people would get there eventually.
Well, I said right from the start, the key thing was I had confidence in all of you that if something went wrong, you would make the right decision. If we're going around in circles in a tender, at some point we're going to go straight. And the only way to make the boat go straight is not me saying do something different, but just you practice. And if you can get it going straight, then you've learned it.
Yeah. So it was giving the space for people to get frustrated with themselves and work it out.
Yeah, we had enough time, didn't we? I'd had Tony there for a little while before you and Launda arrived. And then with you and Launda, we had plenty of time to go through everything. And I say it was by everyone doing everything that we got to learn.
Yeah. Well, how many times can you come up on a buoy and then let it go and then come up on a buoy again, or buoy for the folks listening in this country? So, okay, you planned the whole trip. You planned, let's train for a couple of weeks and sail between the different islands in the Caribbean. We went back to British Virgin Islands where you originally picked up the boat just to make sure everything was finally ready. We got the last of the groceries, which most of which went uneaten the whole trip. But we picked up a few things. And then the plan was to sail from BVI to Wales via the Azores and, you know, go up to latitude 40 and sail along latitude 40. And the next stop for leaving from BVI was planned to be the Azores. So now that would be a 2.5 week without land sail there with a crew that had been together for 10 days.
It would have been a 24 day trip. It would have been 3.5 weeks had we have done it direct. That was the original plan. That plan was never going to be the first choice, but it was somewhat constrained by people had deadlines to get back.
You had flights and things like that.
Exactly. So we had to look at cutting a few corners.
So I've got actually another crew member just walked into the room here. So I'm going to get them just to come forward just a little bit so you can see them. So just interested in listening to the conversation.
Hey, Skippy.
My favorite crew member, top crew member.
My favorite skipper. How are you, Launda? Let me go in again. I can't wait to leave and travel the world again. And I'll cook, definitely. And Tony can never come downstairs.
You're giving away the secrets. We haven't got to that bit yet.
No, I'm sure we're coming on to that bit. Launda, you're more than welcome.
Yes. So we are only missing Tony here. And then we'd have the whole crew back together, a reunion.
Indeed. So, yes.
So we keep talking about that was the plan, but something happened about 7 days out of
BVI. It was half a day from Bermuda, the point we should have been turning right.
We hadn't planned to stop in Bermuda. We were skirting around the south of it.
Yeah, we were We had everything, we had sufficient fuel and water to go the whole way without stopping. And the plan had been that simply to cut a few corners, literally on the chart, to save time. So we could have saved a day here and there.
So you're the skipper of this boat, you're the leader of this team. Tell me what happened that, from your perspective, that derailed us a little.
From my perspective, it's the most terrifying wake-up call that I've ever had and ever want to have. From my peaceful slumbers in the front of the boat to be woken by someone sticking their head through the cabin door, shouting, "Keith, the boat's on fire." Mm-hmm. That was you.
Yep, that was.
And I have never woken with a heartbeat from low to 200 as terrifyingly as that.
It was a little bit like those cartoons that you see people's legs start to spin around until they get traction on the ground. That's kind of what it felt like the moment I said that, and you got out of bed and it was and you were moving.
Yes, I was moving, but what had happened before that? What did you do before you came and told me? Do you remember?
I remember, yeah. So and this is getting more interesting because I just got up. I was going up for the change of shift because we had this shift rotation pattern that you devised that some people want to complain about, but we'll get to that bit later as well. But the shift rotation allowed us to work different shifts, have no more than 6 hours that you were on in any one period, but it was usually less than that as we rotated around. And I was getting up, going up above deck to see if anybody wanted a cup of tea. And I noticed that one of the sheets, the ropes that holds the sail, was flapping, and I couldn't work out why. And I stood up and looked up taller than the other two who were sat down at the end of their night shift. And there were flames coming from the foredeck, at which point I brought this to their attention and ran back downstairs to get the fire extinguisher. I passed one fire extinguisher, Tony, ran forward for the other one and woke you up. And then by the time you and I got back on deck, I think the flames were pretty much out.
So that really summarizes what I was saying about the importance of having the right people. Had I had the wrong people on board, they may have run forward, woken me, saying, "Keith, the boat's on fire, what do we do?" But you didn't. You just told me exactly what you did. You saw it, you told everyone else immediately and gave them the fire extinguisher. You'd taken action without anyone having to instruct you, and that was so key to that situation.
Well, and everybody on deck was now wide awake and alert and doing what needed to be done. So from keeping the boat in the right direction to putting the fire out. And so that goes back to that. If I pick the people who I think have got the right traits to work it out for themselves, the training and everything else we can do. But I have to pick the dependable people in the first place.
Absolutely. All three of you had taken the absolutely right action before I'd even been woken up, which was fabulous. It would only have been 10, 15 seconds more, but that 10 or 15 seconds could have made a significant difference.
So that there was a period after that. Once the fire was out and everybody was up on deck and we'd had a cup of tea, because we're truly British at heart, all of us, and there was a lot of silence. And it seemed very quiet and thoughtful. I'd love to know, as the leader of this, you've just, this crisis could have sunk the ship. I mean, this could have been something major. What was going through your head at that point?
It turns out that it was cosmetic. It could have been major. At that point, I thought it was probably cosmetic and not of a significant nature, but was massively significant in my mind was the confidence that I had, that the three of you had in Ruby May in the boat. Something like this happening, it dents confidence. And the silence, I remember, it was eerie. We were all sitting around just taking in what had actually happened. And that was really important that we digested what had happened and reconciled it in our heads. So we knew exactly what had happened, what we'd done, and the situation that we were in now. It was really important that we understood and we saw what each other had done, but it was then important that we still had confidence in that boat.
Was there some sense of responsibility kind of flashing through and saying, hey, I started this whole thing?
Still in my mind, even to today, I don't know why we had the issue with the solar panel. Why should a solar panel burst into flames? I took photographs after the event of the wiring, and I still have those, and there's nothing wrong with it. Everything that we should have done. And I still cannot understand, even from my research after 6 years, why the panel, and that concerns me. Why did a flexible panel melt and catch fire? It didn't burst into flames. It was plastic, it got very hot and it ignited, but it should not have done. That's the thing I still don't understand why that happened.
So it's more about your lack of understanding and the thought that because you're the kind of person that wants to make sure you're prepped for everything along that line and it shouldn't have happened.
I wanted to understand exactly why it had gone wrong. And that was my thought on the day. Why has this gone wrong? Is it something I have done in installing solar panels? And still to this day, not understanding why, it concerns me that it could happen again. It's an unknown. I'd love to know the answer.
Which we'll probably never know the answer to now. But the flames were only about a foot from the mainsail. And I know when I was sat in that quiet, you're thinking about what could have. And, you know, that this could have been significantly worse. We could have been now putting out the life raft and starting to look at, you know, an exit plan. Now, fortunately, we were only 30 miles from Bermuda, so we may have found some help. But we could also have been lost in the famous triangle. I wonder whether there was an extra burden on you as the skipper in that point, that as you were going through what had happened and what could have happened, was there a sense of extra responsibility?
No, there wasn't. Everything that we had done before that in selecting each other as skipper and crew, everything that we trained for and all of our traits, they were already there. So there was no extra burden because no one had let anyone down. If anyone let anyone down at all, it was me with my wiring. That was my thought.
Right.
So my concern was that I had done something that created that fire. But actually, I was comfortable that we'd all behaved exactly as I would have expected. And that was really key to us carrying on.
So it was, and we spent a couple of days in Bermuda and got to visit Bermuda and have some fun while we checked the repairs, and then set off for the main trip across from between Bermuda and the Azores. This stage, you're in a different place now because you feel like that confidence is there in the team?
Confidence in the team never hiccuped, not in the slightest. We left BVI. We had some great sailing up towards Bermuda. We had a fire, we dealt with it, we moved on to Bermuda repairs and then across. At no point did I have any doubt of any one of the team whatsoever. I did and can still feel the sense in Bermuda of relief when we actually tied up there. Once we dealt with the fire, we were in no danger. We were sailing exactly as we had been before. We had everything that we had before, so we weren't in any way. But just to tarpon Bermuda, for me, was a great sense of relief. I felt quite emotional in Bermuda.
Relief in terms of that we're all safe? Relief in terms of, hey, this is that could have been worse?
I don't think it was relief that we're all safe, because I say I always had absolute confidence in you. If it was a confidence issue, I would have had a lack of confidence about setting off on the next leg, which is the longest section we'll talk about in a moment. I don't know why, but I did feel quite emotional in Bermuda when we arrived there.
Which is interesting, because I felt like when we got there, you just wanted to be on your own for a while with the boat. And, you know, I think we kind of scattered a little bit just because we all needed a little bit of space.
You did. Very consciously, you all disappeared, took yourself off around the island, giving everyone that individual space, which is important, isn't it? Time to sit back and reflect upon what I have done and what each individual has done, and try and work it out, reconcile it in your own head, it wasn't something we could have done differently to change it.
So you mentioned earlier that some of the skills that people brought you weren't aware of. What were some of the most surprising ones when you thought about the trip between Bermuda and the Azores?
Well, it wasn't firefighting, but it may have been the cooking.
So
I was not looking forward to 35 days of flavoured couscous.
We spent about 4 days of flavoured couscous, and then somebody took over, didn't they?
They did indeed. Sometimes a natural just floats to the surface. And I do remember a few conversations before we set off, along the lines of, there's some weird stuff being bought. Are you sure about this?
Well, that was on all sides, wasn't it? We're not quite sure why there were so many tins of tuna.
You know, to be honest, David, I sold the boat just 4 weeks ago. And when I cleared it, there were tins from our trip. Almost 6 years on.
And half a bottle of port.
No, the port is gone. Long gone. No, the absolute unknown for the trip was Launda's cooking. It was awesome. It makes such a difference on a trip like that, where we're stuck in the confines of a small boat in the middle of the ocean, and the quality, the variety and the flavours that she was getting from tin tuna was just unimaginable. And if there was something I learned from the trip, it's to take a Launda with you on every single trip. Just it was fantastic. It really was.
It's the age-old idea of an army marches on its stomach, and the morale booster of saying, what do you fancy for lunch tomorrow? And then somebody shouts out, well, pizza. And we had no flour. And we're in the middle of the Atlantic. And lo and behold, we all got individual pan pizza, which I still say is probably the best pizza I've ever eaten.
I remember the pizza so well. But I also remember announcement that one day we're having Mexican, and something suddenly appears, as if miraculously, which tastes like it's been made in Mexico. It was awesome. Where did the hummus come from? I know where the hummus came from. It came from a can of chickpeas. But we had this most fantastic hummus in the middle of the Atlantic. And it was little things like that. The quality, the diversity, the imagination was just superb.
And from a, you know, from a leadership perspective, it's amazing what a morale boost that can be.
Oh, completely. To not have the mundane, to have something exceptional. The food that I had mid-Atlantic, I've eaten better mid-Atlantic than I have in some expensive restaurants in London. I need to make mention at this point that I did at one point say to Launda, you have to stop cooking. It's just too mad out here. We were bouncing around. I think she'd actually flown backwards over the table and landed on the seat opposite, still holding the frying pan.
And there was food everywhere.
She'd saved most of the food, to her absolute credit.
And there were some days that you slept on that same seat, which could get even more hairy.
Well, it did when I ended up with a pan of water over me. There was one point where we mentioned the last time about preparation. There was one point from my perspective where I did fail to prepare. And that was, I'd been in the Caribbean for 6 months, and every day we sailed back, we went north and it got colder and wetter. And I wasn't prepared mentally or equipped for getting cold and wet. So as we got further north, I was missing the sunshine, again cold, and I didn't have enough warm clothes with me because I simply had packed for the Caribbean and not considered sufficiently far ahead that I'd have to come back.
So you're wrapping yourself in yoga mats and...
Literally, yes. Fortunately, somebody bought a yoga mat. And yeah, that was the if there was a failure in my preparation, it was to really think about the end and coming back to the cold climbs.
Right. So before we get to the cold climbs, we did hit a bit of a storm, probably the stormiest storm we had just east of Bermuda. There was a
I think we had three. When we left Bermuda, we were, as previously said, on a bit of a time scale for various commitments. And we knew we were heading out into some stormy seas. So before we left, we knew the storms were coming, but they were 3 or 4 days away. And we didn't really have the luxury of time to wait for them to pass. Sensibly, you'd wait for it to pass. Actually, we didn't. We went out. And I do remember the night the first big storm hit. We were battered by winds for 6 or 8 hours from one direction. And then at some point, I looked up to a completely clear sky, and on the horizon for 360 degrees, all we could see was thunder and lightning. There was lightning all around the boat on the horizon, and we were the dead center of this low pressure area.
Which is not a good place to be.
You know what's coming next. At some point, whoever hits you on the way through, you're going to get the back end of it. So sure enough, 4 hours later, we were hit by the next one. But we'd survived the first one. We were well prepared for the first one. We got battered by the second one. Again, we were well prepared, and we just kept pushing on. A few days later, we put the motor on and motored for probably 3 days nonstop because there was not a breath of wind.
Yeah. So that storm, though, there was one day, I think we did about 2 miles in the direction we wanted to go in because we spent all the time being bashed back and forth. As a leader of a team in a time like that, when you've just set off and you've made the choice to go out into the storm because of the time commitments we had, what's going through your head?
It was frustrating, but also I hope I'd explained to everyone on board that this is what was going to happen. We were always going to struggle that night with the storm. The wind was the wrong direction. We couldn't fight our way through because it was just too windy. So we accepted we were going to be very much delayed or even pushed backwards. And I think I'd explained that to you, Tony and Launda. So when it happened, we knew it. Yeah. Tell me if I'm wrong.
No, I mean, that was very clear up front, wasn't it? One of the time crunches was we had return tickets. And so we had to be back in the UK for these tickets. But then we said right from the beginning of, if we're not going to make it, we can do something about that. So let's not make that absolute locked in. But, you know, we don't want to do anything dangerous. But equally that, you know, there's some days we sailed nicely and went too fast. And other days we hardly made any progress whatsoever, either because there was a storm that held us back, or it was flat calm, which I think just about in the middle was when it was absolutely glassy calm.
We were probably 1,000 miles away from the nearest big piece of land in any direction, and there was not a breath of wind. It was mirror calm. Yeah. And it was quite bizarre. If you see a dolphin in the distance, you felt the ripple on the boat 10 minutes later because it was so calm.
And so what did we do? We went swimming.
You have to go swimming. It was only 6,000 or 8,000 feet deep. You have to swim. It was fantastic. I think somebody had the birthday somewhere near there too.
Oh, the birthday came after the Azores.
Ah, right.
So we eventually get to the Azores. And, you know, what was that like when you start to see this Jurassic Park-like island in the distance as the skipper again? I know what it was like for a crew member. It was kind of, there was something special about it. But as a skipper, how was that?
It was a little bit frustrating because I knew we were leaving there too soon. And that was such a shame because we've obviously read about the islands and seen the coast, and it was a Jurassic coast. It was 1,000 foot cliffs rising from the sea with clouds atop them. And I would love to have spent more time there. Knowing that it was a brief visit and it was a beautiful, the island of Flores where we stopped, the little bit we saw and the quick trip we took inland, it was a beautiful island. I'd love to spend more time around there.
And we never got to Fayal, which was the original plan as well, the island with the restaurant on the cafe on the transatlantic sailors stop at.
Well, that was one of our discussions, wasn't it? It was part of the decision making. We could have gone there. It was going to be an extra 2, maybe 3 days. And again, we're looking at literally cutting the corners off the route. So instead of going there and then turning northeast, we sort of curled round and we just cut the corner. We could have gone on and completed the crossing, but it would have been those extra days. And again, the time constraints were such that it made sense to do the quick stop in Flores and then move on. And we knew as we were approaching Flores, and certainly when we left Flores, we knew we were going to head towards another storm that turned out to be far longer lasting than the previous one. In severity, I think it was probably more severe, and particularly the fact that it sat there for 5 days and really hampered our progress.
Right.
That was, we were going to hit that whether we stopped or not, unless we waited for a week, because that storm, which was a low pressure over northwest Portugal, sat there for 2 weeks.
And so what was the balance of between the frustration as the skipper of some of the crew had these time limitations and you're wanting to explore and enjoy?
I would have loved to have spent time in the Azores exploring, but that would be a completely separate trip. I didn't feel frustrated about not exploring then, because if you're going to go to somewhere like the Azores, you spend a lot of time there. It's part of your plan that what we were doing was always the cross Atlantic. So getting from the Americas to Europe. So the Azores, yes, nice, but no, I know we have to keep going. One day we'll go back and spend 2 or 3 months there.
And we still had a chunk of route to go. So we had about 8 hours in the Azores and then headed slightly northeast, aiming for Ireland. And
initially we were aiming for probably Land's End would have been the ideal. And with the prevailing southwesterly winds, that should have carried us there quite nicely. But as the prevailing southwesterly winds very quickly turned to be screaming northeasterly gale, 35 to 45 knots, we had to change course a little.
Mm-hmm.
So, from Land's End, we started heading towards Southern Ireland and then Southwest Ireland. And then I think if you look at our plotted course, for 5 days, we were heading firmly towards Iceland.
Which would have been an interesting trip, interesting diversion.
It was an interesting diversion. We had no choice. The wind was dead against us. We couldn't go straight into it. We simply had to tack or beat into it. We weren't tacking, we were simply beating and trying to curl around the top of the low pressure area, which is what we eventually did.
We eventually did, and we eventually skirted along the south of Ireland and ended up in Cork and found somewhere to moor. What was the feeling like, again, as the skipper, when you're saying, hey, we're here, and people start to get off the boat and say goodbye?
Firstly, absolutely amazed at the amount of bottled water we still had on board. When we emptied the boat, I don't know how many bottled waters we took off, but it was astounding. But then, and far more seriously, really disappointed that my crew weren't staying on to Wales.
Yes, because there was another probably day's sail from Cork to Wales, but because of the storms and everything, we weren't quite sure when that was going to be. And Tony had a date to get back to, and we had flights to get back to. And so you lost the crew in Ireland, and you did the sail to Wales single-handed a couple of days later or a day later.
No, I set off the same day. So virtually, you, Launder, and Tony left the boat, and I left the dock and set off on the way to Wales. It was forecast for some strong winds that night, which didn't materialise.
How did that feel being solo again after spending 7 weeks on the boat with a crew?
Very strange. Absolutely normal to set off into an ocean in a boat that I'd just spent the last 6 months, but certainly 35 days on board sailing the Atlantic. So to set off and leave sight of land was just a normal day at the office. There was nothing unusual, except this time I was there by myself. obviously it was more tiring because I was awake and had to be on deck the whole time. The auto helm does all the steering, and that is your absolute reliable crew for steering one direction, but it doesn't avoid ships, it doesn't navigate, it will just take you in the direction. If you're going to hit something, it'll steer you very confidently into it. But it was a strange feeling.
So then you hit South Wales later on, and the Ruby May trip was done for that trip. And as you said earlier, that you've sold the Ruby May and are looking at another thing, another vessel potentially in the future. What were the key lessons from a leadership perspective that you learned from that trip?
The most significant thing that I learned from the trip is, having arrived in Wales and tied upon the dock, I sat down with my very English cup of tea and thought, okay, what do I do now? Because I genuinely had not thought what I was going to do after that point. All the planning, all preparation for years before, which came to fruition, sailing across, we'd finished. That was it. It was over. So I really did not know what I was going to do the next day.
Was it anticlimactic?
No, it was a concern. Because I'd always known what I was going to do. This trip was always going to be the highlight, the peak of what we were doing. And we did it. And I never had any doubt that we would do it. But having done it, I did think, what do I do now? From a leadership perspective, I think something that you said very early on in the previous podcast about the chocolate, have more chocolate on board.
More chocolate, more biscuits.
More chocolate. The chocolate and the endorphins that come from eating chocolate in some people make such a difference. The thing that Launda bought was the food, the quality, the variety, which was phenomenal. Had we not had Launda, the chocolate would have been even more important.
So really you're saying it's the little things.
Absolutely. We thought about all the big things, but little things. There are things that if I was going sailing again, that I might do a little differently in the way I equipped the boat. But actually what we had, I think, worked very well.
So the planning that went on beforehand was critical. The crew and making sure you got the right temperament, that you did the right training with people, and then the little things made the difference.
I just wanted the crew to have more time to see it through, because what we didn't get that was really important is that end of trip debrief.
And we still have.
We should have gone to Wales, had a cup of tea, had a sleep, and spent the next day just bimbling around, doing nothing, and then debrief the trip.
Yeah, because it did kind of come to an end where we were trying to find a police officer to hand ourselves into because of we just landed with looking for immigration, and there was no immigration officer. And
no,
spent our time trying to do that at the same time as working out train timetables, and lo and behold, we were just all on our separate ways again.
It was all very efficient in its inefficiency because the customs and border guards in Southern Ireland just weren't concerned in the slightest. But the efficiency with you getting the train and then the ferry and Tony's flight and the taxi, it all happened so quickly that in our usual manner, everything happened really quickly and it was over and done with and it worked, but we never got a chance to talk about it.
So then as we're doing the debrief now, last quick question is what wouldn't you do next time?
I can't actually think of anything. You were on the crew. What should we have done differently?
So I'd have probably taken a few more books.
The only thing is more time for you, for Tony, for the debrief. That is the only thing that I think it missed.
And what's the value of the debrief in your mind?
it would have given us all time to reflect. And, you know, it's, you have hot debriefs, and we should have had that hot debrief. We should have all had time to reflect and self-congratulate, because what I did is no different to what you, Launda, and Tony did. We all sailed across the Atlantic. It was 3,500 miles, 37 days through some horrendous weather. And actually, we never sat down and said, bloody good job, everyone, because actually it was.
Well, then let's do it now and say bloody good job, everyone. And thank you, Keith Hollis, for joining me on the podcast and sharing your perspective of the story.
You're very welcome, Dave.
And I look forward to the next one. You've been listening to the Humanergy Leadership Podcast. I'm David Wheatley. And we're brought to you by the book, What Great Teams Do Great, available now at all good bookstores. Thanks to Brian Spencer and Finkel for the music. Please share any feedback and suggestions. I'm available through humanergy.com. And go to iTunes, like, subscribe, and leave us a review so that other people can find us. In the meantime, till next time we meet, stay healthy.